Happy Monday from all of us here at Prairie Public. We hope your day is going well. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and this is Main Street. Later in today's show, we'll feature an excerpt from the Great American Folk Show. Prairie Public's program manager, Eric Dethridge, interviews show host and musician Tom Rousseau about his deep connections in North Dakota and the mystical allure of his hometown, Grand Forks. We'll also hear Tony Hoagland's poem, Dickhead, from Studio 47. If you think the poem is about a teenager, you're partially right. But first, here's my interview with Richard C. Bell, voting rights advocate and trial attorney and author of the timely book, Voting, The Ultimate Act of Resistance. Richard Bell, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you very much, Craig. A pleasure to be here.
This is certainly an appropriate time of year for us to visit with you. You are a voting rights advocate and trial attorney. Let me start with, why aren't more people voting?
Studies and polls seem to show all the same things. One is, we have a very decentralized system in the country. I know North Dakota has no voter registration requirement, but we have 50 states with 50 different sets of laws. It makes it very confusing for people, especially in this era when people are moving around a lot because of remote work. So that's number one. People don't necessarily know the laws of their states because they vary. Certainly, lack of a civics education. It's one of my pet peeves. Schools are just not teaching civics with how it should be done, meaning that this is a completely nonpartisan issue. Civics is about your obligations as a citizen. And I just don't think there are generations now that have received that message and just the very basic things about our government works and how our society works. I think also, the apathy and disengagement is obvious, but also that's sometimes simply an excuse. I mean, we live in a democracy. We're in a legal and moral compact between the citizens and its government. And it's up to us to keep our democracy and to keep our way of life. And the only way you do that is to participate. It's not a spectator sport democracy. And I think that's a big problem. And I also think this era of disinformation and misinformation and distrust of government, this doesn't help anyone. You need to stick to verifiable sources, whether that's the internet, whether that's the local newspapers, whether that's national newspapers, but or magazines. You've got to stick to verifiable sources. So I think all of these things combined has made us into a nation that doesn't vote anywhere near in the percentages we should be.
You are the founder of VotingForBeginners.com, which is a free 10-episode video series teaching voters how to properly register. It's not a factor here in North Dakota. It is, though, in Minnesota, where some of our listeners reside, but also how to successfully cast their ballots and have their votes counted. What do you tell them in that series?
So I go through, obviously, because there are 50 states and different rules, but I go through generally what the process is, how to register. There are many people out there, and you may not believe it, they don't know you have to register to vote in other 49 states. So that's a big problem. They don't know about deadlines. They don't know about what happens if they move or they change an address, or how can they get a mail-in ballot, or when do they have to send it back, or what is a drop box? All of these topics are things that most people are not taught. And unless you're engaged on our process, you're not going to know about it. So I did these 10 video episodes online in VotingForBeginners.com to teach people, look, there's a system out there and there are lots of resources. And one of the things I always tell people is go to vote.gov, that's the official government website, and you put in your state and it will tell you the particular rules of your state because things change over time. So that's very important. And I'd say the most important lesson is that voting is your way of expressing what kind of government, what kind of laws, what kind of country you want to have. And I always go back to someone that most people don't know of, Vernon Damon Sr. And he was a voting rights advocate, African-American voting rights advocate in the 1960s. And he was murdered by the Klan. And his epitaph says it all. If you don't vote, you don't count. And I think that's the message that I'm trying to get across to people.
You served as an election protection attorney during several U.S. presidential elections, most recently in Pennsylvania during the 2020 vote. What did you do?
Sure. So voter protection, and, you know, there's a lot of misinformation about what that really means. So let me make it real simple. So voter protection are volunteers, mostly lawyers, who are there at polling places, or sometimes you're in court, sometimes you're inside the Board of Elections, and you make you're there to observe, you're there to inform, you're there to report problems. You want to make sure things are going smoothly, and if people have problems, that I can give them information that will help them, because some people get to polling place, they're told you're at the wrong polling place, or that we can't find your registration. And these are problems that if it's election day, they're much more difficult to be dealt with, but that's what I do. Now, in 2020, I had a different role. I was actually in a county board of elections office observing the opening and counting of mail-in ballots, because it was in Pennsylvania, and Pennsylvania has some laws and continuing court cases to this day about the specificity of when these ballots are to be counted, and what are clerical errors and what are not substantial errors. So I was there along with observers from other parties to make sure that the process was done properly, and to make sure when things were ambiguous that they were put aside, and so that voter could file what's called the provisional ballot so we can see what vote is going to count or not. So that was my role in 2020. Most of the time, I'm outside polling places telling voters what they need to do when they come back with problems, because you can't believe how many problems there are in they can't find my registration, or they're asking me for an ID and that's not the law in the state and I don't have it with me, or there's a particular ID I have which I think is right, but they're saying it's not. And my message always in advance to voters, those days, it's that day, it's too late. We just have to resolve the problem instantly. But my message is always three votes, three things to do early, early, early. You got to register early, obviously not in North Dakota, but in the rest of the country. You have to check your registration early. Go to that vote.gov site. Make sure, even though you voted in many elections, you're still registered. And vote early. Because when you vote early, whether it's in person or by mail, problems can be resolved. You have time to fix things. And that's what I try to tell everyone.
I want to ask you about voter suppression. There's lots in the media about voter suppression, about people who want to mail in their ballot. Nope, nope, nope. You've got to come in person. Is voter suppression an issue that you are concerned about in our country?
Oh, yes, very much so. It's not as prevalent everywhere, of course. The problem becomes this. There's legislation is still not passed, the Freedom to Vote Act. And basically, it deals with many issues of voter suppression. And voter suppression is not what people think. It's not someone necessarily, hopefully not, standing in front of a polling place with a baseball bat and says, you can't vote today. No, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the process that ends up not allowing people to vote because of procedural things. And like I said, it's decentralized law. So let me give you a few examples of this Freedom to Vote Act, which is still not passed Congress. But here's some things. Early voting. It would allow it in all 50 states for at least 2 weeks, 10 hours a day and weekends. It's a good thing. It's common sense. Let people have that opportunity so that they don't miss out. They may have to go to school or work or have obligations. Making Election Day a national holiday, that solves a lot of problems where people literally because of work or school or other obligations, can't get to a voting place. Mail-in voting that you mentioned, having drop boxes in lots of places so people could just throw it in there. You don't have to worry about mail problems, and having what's called no excuse mail-in voting, because there are a number of states that still require a reason, as opposed to why should there be a reason? If you want to vote by mail, vote by mail. Voter ID became a big issue, but in this legislation, voter ID, if it's required by your state, fine. It would just be a national standard of what types of ID, because not everybody has the driver's license or the non-driver's license, but you could have, you know, electric bill and other lists or e-copies, things like that. And you wouldn't have this in North Dakota, but automatic voter registration, which in the rest of the country is very important, meaning if you go to the motor vehicle office, you go to a state office, you are automatically going to be registered to vote unless you want to opt out. So here we don't have to worry about the whole process of people going through the procedures, doing it correctly. It will be done correctly. You're in a government office. It would just be done. Same day voter registration. Now you have same day voting, but this will be, you can vote by registering on that last day, because we have so many checks and balances in the software systems around the country to make sure that that's viable. And online voter registration, making sure you read about these things called voter purges. Georgia is a state right now where it's being contested, where they compare names, they purge lots and lots of voters off the rolls. They say it doesn't match up. Many, many errors are made. So this would just make that if you're going to do a purge, you have to give 48-hour notice to the voter that you did it and how they can resolve it if it's not correct. But these, you know, you live in a very common sense state. I just think these are common sense, and they result in suppression, meaning people that are eligible to vote don't get to vote.
We are enjoying our conversation with Richard Bell. He's a voting rights advocate and trial attorney. He's author of the very topical book, Voting, the Ultimate Act of Resistance. What's your take on misinformation and disinformation, and especially claims about voting procedures that are just erroneous, that are somehow floated to be true?
I consider it one of the most dangerous threats to our democracy, because disinformation, which is intentional, misinformation, which is unintentional, it doesn't really matter. If the public is not getting facts and truth, then we all have a big problem, because we're entitled to our own opinions, but not our own facts. So we need to make sure that everyone goes to reliable sources. Like I cited that government website, vote.org. It's excellent. It tells every state resident, for whatever your state is, what your rules are, what has to happen. I also always recommend the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights on the Law, a nonpartisan organization. For years, they have been doing election protection where they'll give you information about your state on the phone. It's 866-OUR-VOTE, 866-OUR-VOTE. They'll give you information on a telephone call, so there'll be a back and forth. And if you're standing in a polling place, you can call them from there if you're having a problem. This is what we need to do. We need to go to those kinds of sources. We don't have to worry that they're giving us disinformation and misinformation. And one's a government source, one's a nonpartisan source. They are there to give you the facts and the truth, because the greatest danger in a democracy is when people don't have the facts and don't have the truth.
I've read a lot about, and you've heard a lot about too, about foreign interference in our elections. And honestly, it's beyond me how that can be impactful. But maybe that's because of the sources that I try to get my news from. Have you experienced that? And is that also something that you are concerned about?
I haven't personally experienced it, because like you, I am very meticulous in going to sources that I can authenticate, whether it's NPR or it's of the local newspaper or it's websites that are verifiable old news organizations. So I personally haven't, but you and I are from a different generation. There's two generations, basically, that rely on social media and the internet for a lot of their information. And that's where you can get foreign interference of disinformation, misinformation. And yeah, it concerns me greatly.
How about voting machine security? There is an effort that I can tell you in Wyoming that we should probably be counting our votes by hand. We probably should not allow any drop boxes anywhere. We probably should not have mail-in ballots because there's fraud everywhere, is the claim, which I don't believe. However, there are people that do. How can we be sure that when we cast a vote, it's counted, and it's counted just once?
Okay, first of all, there have been studies, not just for 2020, which obviously we had 60 legal cases, none of them found fraud. But we've had studies done over 20 years by the Conservative Heritage Foundation, by MIT, by the Liberal Brennan School of Justice and Center for Justice. And all of those studies, as well as obviously the court cases from 2020, show that in-person and mail fraud is a myth. It is so infinitesimal. It's not that it never happens, but it literally is about 9 decimal points out. It does not affect any of the elections. So we need once again to go with facts. And the facts show that the election officials run very clean elections, are very precise in the equipment, are very precise in the monitoring. Even in 2020, the head of the division that oversaw that said it was the cleanest election that he can recall. But what we need to remember is it's easy to fester distrust with rumors and disinformation. But when we go to the facts, like I said, it was across the board. It was Academic Place. It was a conservative organization. It was a liberal organization. They all came up with the same facts. The voter fraud is basically a myth. Does it never happen? No, it happens a few times. It was not in any kind of numbers that should concern any of us.
What should we know about gerrymandering, the concept of drawing lines on maps to impact the outcome of an election to perhaps underrepresent a certain segment of the population? In your eyes, is that a bigger issue than we know?
It's a gigantic issue. And, you know, California did a great job. They ended up having a law where they have these bipartisan commissions that now draw the lines. That is going to be essentially the only way we're going to get it under control, because yes, both parties are having these maps in many instances where you are clearly discriminating either by party or by race or other factors, and making sure that certain congressional districts are just always going to go one way as long as you have a R or a D next to you. And that's not fair. We want fairness in the system. So yes, I think it's very concerning. And actually, that is also part of that John R. Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. It addresses the gerrymandering issues.
What's your biggest concern about the upcoming presidential election?
My biggest concern is turnout. Because we cannot exist as a democracy if we don't all participate. And when I hear people throw up their hands and say, I don't like him, I don't like her, I'm not going to vote. Well, you know what? Then you just gave away a right that people have died for throughout history in this country. And to me, that you are desecrating the democracy you live in. So I say participation is everything. You know, I was shocked when I first got into this, and I learned how low a percentage we are compared to the rest of the world in voting. So in 2020, we had our highest percentage in our presidential election since 1900. It was 66 point something percent of eligible voters. We're still, with that number, 31st among highly developed nations in percentage of eligible voters that vote. to me, it's criminal. How can we, the United States of America, the bastion of democracy, the world's longest continuous democracy, be 31st in voter turnout? Youth, this is unbelievable. They did a great job in 2020. They had their highest percentage ever, 18 to 24-year-olds. 51.4%, that means half didn't show up. So yes, it's always my greatest concern is turnout. I really don't understand why anyone wouldn't want to exercise their right to participate in a system. I always say that voting turns anger into action, and it turns ideas into laws. And there's a lot of people that are angry. So how about we go from rage to engage, and we get educated about issues that are important to us, whether it's climate change or women's reproductive rights or farming or education. Doesn't matter. Whatever is important to you, get educated and understand that there will never be the perfect changes that you want. But if you want to move toward them and have things happen that you think are important, then you better get engaged and you absolutely better vote.
Is there a state, in your opinion, that gets voting absolutely right, that does it perhaps better than others?
A single state, no. You know, because the places that I'm sent are always places that have problems. I've been to numerous states like Florida and Ohio and Pennsylvania. I go to places where problems arise.
Interesting that you're mentioning swing states, by the way.
Yes, I always go to swing states. Because unfortunately, I'm not a fan of the Electoral College system, but it's what it is. It's our system. And we all know it's a handful of people and a handful of states that really deciding a presidential election for us.
So then the state that does it the worst, are you better able to comment about that?
I'd say Georgia, while they certainly did a job in 2020 of doing it correctly, in terms of, you know, if everything was verifiable. But since then, wow, they have passed a number of laws, and I worry a lot about them. And voter purging and polling places being closed down. The one that worries me the most is the law about a state board can take away the powers of election officials in counties if they don't think that they're doing things properly, and whether or not they're going to certify votes. These things concern me greatly. So Georgia is a state that I would single out.
Do you think that on Tuesday, November 5th, we're going to know who the next president of the United States is?
No.
Really?
No, I don't, because if it's anywhere near as close as 2020, and it's predicted at this moment anyway to be closer, there's just too many variables, because there is a lot of mail-in ballots. It takes time. There's a lot of states, this is incredible to me, that do not start opening those ballots. I was right there in Pennsylvania. I actually watched the process where they don't start opening the ballots until election day. You've got most of those ballots in already. Many states start opening the ballots as they come in. They put them in the machines, but they just don't tabulate them until election day. That's fine, because it literally takes, you know, very little time to do tabulation. So that's one of the big reasons why we wait so long.
My guest has been Richard C. Bell, voting rights advocate and trial attorney and author of Voting, the Ultimate Act of Resistance. He's also the founder of VotingForBeginners.com, which has on that website a free 10-episode video series teaching all voters how to successfully cast their ballots and have their votes counted. Richard, it's been a pleasure. I'd like to visit with you maybe a day or two after the election. Would you be up for that?
I certainly would. I'll be. Looks like I'll be in Pennsylvania this year again, because that's a hot spot, as you know.
It sure is. Thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
My pleasure. Everyone vote.
Coming up, Eric Dethridge interviews Tom Brousseau about his deep roots in North Dakota and the enchanting qualities of Grand Forks. Don't touch that dial. Main Street returns after this news.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone Energy Cooperative. Touchstone Energy Cooperatives comprise a nationwide network of over 730 consumer-owned electric cooperative utilities dedicated to community, integrity, accountability, and innovation.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In this excerpt from the Great American Folk Show, Eric Deathridge chats with musician Tom Brousseau about his deep connections to North Dakota and the mystical allure of his hometown, Grand Forks. They explore themes of heritage, the symbolic Red River, and the experience of being an old soul in modern times. The conversation culminates with Tom sharing his song, The Flood of 1997, reflecting on a significant event in the community's history.
Tom Brousseau on the Great American Folk Show podcast. We are turning the tables on him today. He gave us the North Dakota homespun, My Prairie Rose. So what makes Grand Forks special, almost mythological to you?
You know, North Dakota is just a series of feelings and of vibes that I've collected over my lifetime. And then even more, I feel like in my own life, I've always been in this environment where I get to go to the edge of town and I get to look out at this beautiful landscape and feel the elements. I'm an elemental person and I try to harness that, I guess, whenever I write songs about North Dakota. And be it I'm writing songs about North Dakota in North Dakota or elsewhere, well, you might just say that I'm one of these people who has North Dakota on the brain and in the heart. But what that's comprised of, oh my gosh, I don't know. Stardust, wheat dust, mud, that cold air that comes straight down from Canada that keeps us all humble and handsome, hopefully. and the remembrances of all of those people, my family and others that came to this part of the world once upon a time. I just feel so much a part of that. We have this other character in Grand Forks. It's not a person. It's not a location. It's not something that even has a voice so much, but it's very much a character. And that character is the Red River. We have this other thing that is very much a lifeline, that is very much a carrier of those stories and experiences of the past. That is where the civilization came to at one point, and that is the Red River, this mysterious thing that flows from the south to the north. In some ways, this is a tattoo on my soul. In some ways, I'm very fearful of it because still to this day, I've never really even dipped my finger into the Red River.
Really?
Because it's just it's kind of this force. I'm almost afraid to. I'm afraid that I might become part of it.
It is kind of like this friction. You know, it's interesting. You talk about the winds from the north coming from Canada, and you got this river that flows from the south to the north. It's almost like this friction, and there's something sort of mystical about that friction that's in the air in Grand Forks.
I think you described it perfectly in that one sentence: mystical and magical and cosmic, spiritual.
Some of what you're describing sort of plays into what some people know of you, and I doubt if you'd be offended if I say a lot of folks describe you as kind of an old soul, a fresh Scandinavian face, but an older soul. Did you always feel that?
I always did. You know, I when I was growing up, I was in love, just in the pure sense of the word, with some of the idols that were presented to my age group, pop idols and movie star idols. But I always was so much more interested in what my grandparents were doing. I was always interested in what they were wearing, in what music they were listening to, and the time they took when they spoke, how they took their time, how they didn't rush anything, and they were diligent. These things, to me, took years to really adopt, but I was just interested in a group of people that were so instrumental in the direction of the world, but were kind of dying out at the same time.
So jump forward a little bit, Tom, to your trek to the West Coast. Nick Harcourt's playing, you know, the famous DJ at KCRW, is playing your stuff and people are coming to your shows more. How did you speak to crowds about where you came from? How did you represent?
The part of me being on stage and explaining to people where I came from was very easy because I'd been doing it for a couple of years by then. And if anything, that was the thing that I would talk about before I would even play a song. And in many ways, that was the thing that made me feel comfortable about being on the stage in that big city in front of people that some of them I didn't know, and some of them were there because the place might have been a hot spot to see, you know, budding songwriters. And some of those people were actors and actresses. At any given point, you could look out and pretty much see that actor or actress that you'd grown up seeing on the TV or in movies. And I would set the tone a little bit right from the get-go by just introducing myself very simply, saying, my name is Tom Brousseau. I'm from Grand Forks, North Dakota. That one thing alone, I think, gave people an indication as to what they could be about to hear. And it also helped me feel a little bit comfortable about delivering it to them.
I'm sure, like, it also was alluring, too. You might say, hi, I'm Tom Brousseau. I'm from Grand Forks, North Dakota. You say that people kind of expect something. I bet a lot of people didn't know what to expect. It was kind of unlocking a mystery box for them. And I'm sure that was, a bit exotic for those in the crowd. Now, you did mention that there were some actors, famous people. You made many friends out there, including some famous ones, many of whom, who have shown up on the Great American Folk Show. Why is forming and maintaining friendships like that so important in this line of work?
These are the people who might truly be the only ones right off the bat who understand what you're doing. I've often heard, as a particular songwriter, being labeled a singer-songwriter's songwriter. Mm. You know, in other words, someone that other artists go to because they just immediately connect with them. John Prine, for example, I've heard that said about him. One of my first album releases was for a record I did on Loveless Records called What I Mean to Say is Goodbye. It was a sold-out show, and I was able to have some friends come up and join me. But then I just so wanted to be done with the show, too, so I could greet people and tell them thank you, which I did. And as I was greeting people as they were leaving and selling a T-shirt and a record, I just knew there was something out of the corner of my eye, this beautiful woman was slowly making her way down the line to thank me or to tell me that the show was good or to say what a fun time they had. It was Monica Lewinsky.
Monica Lewinsky is one of your fans.
Monica Lewinsky. And I didn't know what to say, but we had this moment where she was smiling and I was smiling. And she thanked me, and I said, thank you. And we had this big hug. Oh. And I just was so, so pleased that I was able to do this album release and that I was able to connect with people. And you know, that's the thing about these shows at Largo is that everyone is in the same boat. It doesn't matter who you are, what you've done. People who were there to see shows were in the same boat. And what a lovely time that was, as you can imagine.
Wow. And knowing what all Monica Lewinsky went through and just the hell she went through in her life, that had to be nice to see her smiling and enjoying your work like that.
Amazing. And to a certain extent, I'm so glad that she was contemplating this album, which was all about North Dakota.
Mr. Ambassador, so we are turning the tables on the host with the most, North Dakota representing Tom Bruce. So today, of course, you are listening to the Great American Folk Show podcast. I don't have to tell you that. You come this far. So we're doing a live session. I'm Eric Dethridge in Fargo, and that's Tom Brusseau in Medora. Through the magic of, internet technology, we're together. So Tom, we're going to go back to your hometown for our next song, and I don't think this one needs much setup.
Eric, I think I'm going to do one that I wrote for an album called Grand Forks. And this one is simply called The Flood of 1997.
Down along the banks of the mighty Red, the river was slowly rising out of bed. The warmer it got, the stronger she became. She's gonna be a household name. Well, think of all the power needed to put forth, flowing from the south on up to the north, from the lonesome valley to Lake Winnipeg, a body of water with many a leg. We're gonna need them all if we're gonna save our town. Release the kids from school and shut the schools down. Send out a message. We need the desert sand. We need every able body and every able hand. Where people come together, form into a chain. People come together, form into a train. Fill the bags with sand, tie them tight with twine. When this is finished, send them on down the line. Stretch to the max and put to the test. No real sign that the river was gonna crest. Leaks on the levee, worms in the yard. A state of emergency was declared, and then they called in the guard. The first thing they'd done was put a wall of clay down Belmont Road. It was very little time in such a heavy load. The second thing they'd done was later in the eve. They came around to tell us, folks, it's time to leave. The red rose o'er the barrier, and then began to drown all the lower line areas of town. It was a matter of time before she would arrive. All the pretty houses down along Reeves Drive, into every shop, into every hall, into every corner, into every mall, to the pews in every church, to the stools in every bar, to everybody's basement, everybody's car.
That was Eric Deathridge with Tom Brousseau, host of The Great American Folk Show.
Hey, lifelong learners, did you know Humanities North Dakota offers grade-free classes? These once-a-week online courses are taught by some of the nation's most engaging faculty. Learn a language, construct a poem, explore democracy in America, and so much more. Public University is learning for the sake of learning. Explore Humanities North Dakota programming at humanitiesnd.org.
This is Main Street from Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Tony Hoagland's poem, Dickhead, explores the transformative power of language in the tumultuous journey of adolescence. The poem, read by Patrick Hicks from Studio 47, poignantly captures the intersection of vulnerability and bravado that defines the passage into adulthood.
This is poetry from Studio 47. Welcome. Today's poet is Tony Hoagland. Hoagland was born in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, on November 19, 1953. His father was a doctor in the Army, and this meant his family moved around quite a bit during his childhood. In fact, Hoagland grew up in a number of military bases around the world, including Hawaii, Alabama, Texas, and Ethiopia. He attended the University of Iowa, where he received his BA, and then he went to the University of Arizona for his MFA. According to at least one source, during his college years, he joined several communes, picked apples for a living, followed the Grateful Dead, and became a Buddhist. Over the course of his career, he published a number of books, including Sweet Ruin, Donkey Gospel, What Narcissism Means to Me, and Priest-turned-Therapist Treats Fear of God. Known for his witty poems about modern life, he won a number of awards, including a fellowship from the Guggenheim Foundation, a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship, and the Mark Twain Award. He passed away on October 23, 2018, in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Today's poem is the evocatively titled Dickhead. I'm fond of saying to my students that the first thing we read in a poem is not the first line, it is, in fact, the title. This particular poem has a title that all but demands that we read it. There is immediate interest for what this poem might be about. And what is it about, you might ask? Well, it's about the acquisition of language. It's about how we learn the words of adults when we're teenagers. It's about how adult phrases can make us feel adult ourselves. Words offer identity and belonging, and the right words, said at the right time, can make us feel bigger and more powerful than we really are. This is Dickhead by Tony Hoagland. To whoever taught me the word dickhead, I owe a debt of thanks. It gave me a way of being in the world of men when I most needed one, when I was pale and scrawny, naked, goose-fleshed as a plucked chicken in a supermarket cooler, a poor forked thing stranded in the savage universe of puberty, where wild jockstraps threw across the steamy skies of locker rooms, and everybody fell down laughing at jokes I didn't understand. But dickhead was a word as dumb and democratic as a hammer, an object you could pick up in your hand and swing, saying dickhead this and dickhead that, a song that meant the world was yours enough at last to bang on like a garbage can. And knowing it, and having that beautiful ugliness always cocked and loaded in my mind, protected me and calmed me like a psalm. Now I have myself become a beautiful ugliness, and my weakness is a fact so well established that it makes me calm, and I am calm enough to be grateful for the lives I never have to live again. But I remember all the bad old days back in the world of men when everything was serious, mysterious, scary, hairier and bigger than I was. I recall when flesh was what I hated, feared, and was excluded from. Hardly knowing what I did or what would come of it, I made a word my friend.
Poetry from Studio 47 is hosted and curated by Patrick Hicks, Tony Hoagland, Dickhead from Donkey Gospel, published by Grey Wolf Press, copyright 1998, used with permission by The Permissions Company, LLC, all rights reserved. This episode was recorded at Augustana University and produced by Peter Folliard. Thank you for listening.
North Dakota Native American Essential Understanding Number 1 is about sacred relatives. It states, Native people practice a deep interconnectedness with the land, the resources, the water, all living things, and all human beings. Land stewardship, respect for all two-legged, four-legged, winged, crawlers, and swimmers, and a strong belief in the sacredness of all human beings are key elements for our spirituality.
In this episode of Dakota Date Book, we'll hear from Kevin Locke, enrolled member of the Standing Rock Nation, in part two of Hihankaga and the Milky Way.
So then, if you look straight up on the, you know, the Milky Way kind of runs north-south, but it does shift straight up overhead, then there's a real, clearly you can see the main band of the Milky Way, you know, but there's a part there where it forks. There's a fork there, and the fork just trails off. So the brightest star there in that fork, I have no idea what that's called in English, but that's Hihankaga, right? That's right there. So the Hihankaga stands there and guards that fork. And so then when a person's coming, when a person passes on and they're making that journey from afar, that Hihankaga will shout out and says, Nituehe! They'll say, who are you? Who are you? And then as they get close, they says, Taku inichiapihe. And what is your name? So then that person has to give their name at that time. Then as soon as that person gives their name, then their reality becomes manifest upon that person. And so this is why you see these pictures of these 19th century, how they bedeck themselves. They attire themselves in the way that they want to present themselves before Hihankaga. All the markings that they use, you know, the feathers, they represent all the good deeds, the generosity, the acts of magnanimity that they've done.
I'm Scott Simpson. If you'd like to learn more about the North Dakota Native American Essential Understandings and to listen to more Indigenous elder interviews, visit www.teachingsofourelders.org.
Dakota Date Book is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota. Funding for this series is from Humanities ND and the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply appreciative that you have joined us today. Tomorrow on the show, we'll revisit the Main Street Summit and hear Governor Doug Burgum's thoughts on the upcoming property tax initiative. Our director of radio, Ann Alquist, was there, and we'll get her insights on the governor's comments. That's tomorrow here on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.